So, welcome. We're delighted to host this little debut of what I know will be a leading work in the area. It's the Oxford Handbook of Language and the Law, edited by our own Professor Peter Tiersma and Lawrence Solon of Brooklyn Law School. This dynamic duo have paired up on a lot of other projects in the past. This is really such an impressive work. I'm eager to hear about the process and what you all have to say about it. So I'm not going to say anything more except to turn the microphone over to Peter, who will introduce the rest of the panel. So, Peter.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Gold. It's great to be here. Thank you all for coming. And I'd like to briefly start out by introducing our panelists. Roger Shai. Roger is a linguist originally from Georgetown. He's now retired for the last 10 or so years, living in Montana. He continues to be very active. He's written 10 books on language and law, and he's still working on additional books. He just doesn't stop. Now, maybe there's not much else to do in Montana. But anyway, he has written a huge, he's really the eminence grise of the field of language and law, certainly in terms of being a linguist. Then we have Larry Solon, often confused with our own former Larry Solom, but he's written a huge amount on language and law as well, and we've also co-authored various things. Larry is a faculty member at Brooklyn Law School in New York. And then finally, we have Richard Leo, formerly from Irvine Criminology and now at the University of San Francisco. He's an expert on interrogations, and so he'll be talking about some of the linguistic issues that arise during interrogations. So I'm going to start by giving you a little bit of an overview of the book in this, what we call a book launch. That was Jeff Atik's turn. Jeff Atik helped organize this panel and decided we ought to have a book launch. And it's a nice metaphor, right? We're about to set it off, to sail off into the distance. I actually, however, sort of prefer to call it a symposium, which is a bit like a symposium. Now, symposium is Latin, right, ending in I-U-M. Symposion is the Greek form, the original ending in I-O-N. Now, symposion, what is a symposion? Well, I didn't know myself, but a month or so ago, someone gave me a book on drinks that have influenced the world. Coffee, tea, wine, beer, and so forth. And so I was reading about the Greeks. The Greeks, of course, were great lovers of wine. They made a lot of it, and they drank a lot of it. And they very often would get together, men only, they'd get together, and they would spend hours discussing philosophy, sports, who's going to be at the next Olympics, you know, that sort of thing, or whatever other topic. They'd have these huge discussions and debates, and during the whole time, they would drink wine. Now, you might think, if they're drinking all that wine, aren't they going to get very drunk? What kind of discussion are they going to have? And the answer to that, they thought about this. The Greeks were not into losing control of yourself. Self-control was very important. So what the Greeks did is they would mix their wine with water. It was always at least half water. And that way they could drink during the entire symposium and still have coherent discussions. So I thought this is a bit like a symposium. We're going to have a discussion, maybe some debates, and we're going to drink some wine. We could do it at the same time, except that I think most people in our culture don't want to mix their wines with water. And if you're not willing to mix it with water, I think we better reserve the wine till the end, or we're going to end up with some sort of drunken debauchery in the dean's here. Frankly, we wouldn't want to do that. Anyway, the Oxford Handbook on Language and Law. What can we say about it? First of all, it's a book. I think it's a rather nice book, actually. But it's a real book. And that in itself is sort of interesting these days, in an era where more and more so-called books are appearing electronically, right? And that's well and good, but sometimes it's nice to have a real book in your hand. Now, books have been around, even though they seem to be, they're not really disappearing, but they're certainly not being used as much as they used to. Books have been around for a long time, probably a couple thousand years. So we have a long tradition here of books. Now, they arose in the Roman Empire, it turns out. Before there were books, people would write on all kinds of different things. Mesopotamians wrote on clay tablets. The Egyptians wrote on pieces of papyrus and so forth. The ancient Chinese would write on vessels very often, bronze vessels. But if you want to have a longer document, you know, you need more than one piece of parchment. So what they would do is they would start to attach pieces of parchment to each other, make a very long piece of parchment. And then they could write a long text, you know. And then if they wanted to store it, how do you store such a long piece of text? You roll it up. So they would roll it up. And then they have these long rolls of parchment. And then someone had the idea of adding a stick on each end. And what do you have now? You have a scroll, right? And nowadays, we don't use scrolls all that much, but they still are very significant in Jewish culture, for example, in that the most temples, I think, are supposed to have a scroll containing the Torah, right? So scrolls are still used. Now, they're great in some senses. They hold a fair amount of information, but there are some drawbacks. One is, how do you find the piece of text you're looking for? Well, you scroll. You have to, it can take a while, right? Until you finally get to that one verse you're looking for. They are not really a horribly efficient use of parchment because you only write on one side. You don't write on the other side. And there's a limit to how big a scroll can be. I mean, a scroll, you know, once they get really big, it's just no longer practical. So the Romans came up with a different idea called a codex. And the idea with a codex was you take a bunch of pieces of parchment that are about the same size, and you place them on top of each other. And you bind them together on one side, often using string, for example, or thread. And now you've got what looks like a modern book, right? You can, you have pages in a sense, you can flip through it and easily get, if you number the pages, you can easily find page 73. Just sort of open it up, there you are. And you can write on both sides of the page. So you've doubled the amount of information you can get on that parchment, which was very expensive in those days. And you could have a much longer documents. And that turned out to be handy, especially for Christians, because the Bible contains not only the Jewish Torah, but a whole bunch of other books. It's very long. Most Bibles are over 1,000 pages, modern copies of it. So you needed to have, scrolls wouldn't work anymore. You needed a codex. And so that, in a sense, the popularity of the codex, somewhat tied to Christianity, Judaism being tied more to scrolls. But anyway, codex became a very popular means of preserving information. And you have to admit, it's a nice way to preserve information. Sometimes it's nice to have something in your hands. And in fact, I think every one of you ought to have one of these on your bookshelf. All right. Now, let's talk a little bit more about this codex. Getting back to the codex, mentioned the Romans. The Romans never really tried to write all of their law in one place. That idea, I guess, never really occurred to them. But it did occur several hundred years after the Roman Empire collapsed, and what remained was the Eastern Roman Empire, centered in what's now Turkey, in Constantinople. And one of the emperors, Justinian, decided, wouldn't it be nice, and he considered himself to be a Roman emperor, even though Rome had fallen to the barbarians, wouldn't it be nice to have all our law in one place, sort of easily accessible? So he told these scholars, I want you to find all of the Roman law that you can find, and I want you to write it up and condense it, make it rational, and make it logical, and put it into a book form, book being, of course, a codex. And the result was the French version of the word codex, a code. We call that today Justinian's Code, which contained pretty much all that you needed to know about Roman law, at least as far as Justinian was concerned. The story's a little more complicated than that, but that's essentially what happened. So Justinian's Code was used as the law of the Byzantine Empire, completely unknown in Western Europe. By now, Roman law had pretty much disappeared after the barbarians had burned Rome down and so forth. until the 11th century, when someone found a copy of Justinian's Code in a library in Pisa, in Italy. And Pisa is not too far from Bologna. And in Bologna, there were a bunch of scholars who were interested in law, and they got a hold of copies, and they started making copies of Justinian's Code. And they started to teach students who were interested in law Justinian's Code. And students started to come from all over Europe to study this Code of Justinian. And they went back to their home countries, and they took along copies and their knowledge. And so the civil law of Europe is based almost entirely, or at least originally, I don't want to exaggerate the story, but based very largely on this code or codex of the Emperor Justinian. That, of course, had a big impact also on the language of the civil law system, because when they needed terminology, they turned to Justinian's Code. So they used what were essentially Roman law in Latin, of course, terminology, and that even today forms the basic terminological basis of the civil law system. Now, English law, on the other hand, across the channel, they didn't go to Bologna to learn law. They went to London. In fact, they sort of turned their noses at Roman law. They had developed their own law, which, of course, we all know today as the common law system. And they taught it in London at the Inns of Court, not at universities. So the English are probably the only ones who didn't go to Bologna originally to learn from the Roman law. And so they developed their own system, and so they didn't have nearly the impact on the law. We don't have nearly the impact that Justinian's Code and Latin had on the civil law of Europe. That's a unifying force in the European civil law, which the common law in England and in former English colonies lack, because we developed the common law system. Our law was much more impacted by another event in the 11th century, and that was the Norman Conquest. When the Normans came over from France, they conquered England. The aristocracy became French-speaking. And when they established courts and a legal system, they used French. And so as a result, our legal system is based very much on French language. So that's one of the fundamental differences between the civil law and the common law system. Well, if you want to know more about this, you can read part one of the handbook. Vocabulary and grammar is also something we discuss in part one. One of the things I think we all know about legal language is that it tends to have relatively long sentences, very long sentences. And one of the articles written by a Finnish scholar, Risto Hiltunen, points out that over the past 20 years, sentences in the common law system have been getting quite a bit shorter. And he points out that this may be a result of the plain English movement, that it actually is having some impact and that we're having somewhat shorter sentences. Now, to some extent, I think that is being outweighed by the fact that the legal documents themselves seem to be getting longer and longer. At least that's my perception. So we have longer legal documents with shorter sentences. Is that an improvement? Well, I'll leave that up to you. But it is interesting that scholars have found that contracts, for example, and statutes in the common law system are approximately three times as long as equivalent contracts and statutes in the civil law system, say a German or French contract. Why? You know, I think the answer is probably largely in the adversarial system, right? That lawyers here draft documents in such a way that they avoid the possibility of creating loopholes. They don't want to create ambiguities. So they make the documents longer and longer in order to cover every conceivable loophole that might otherwise arise. But anyway, that's a bit about part one. In part two, we talk about legal interpretation. I'm not going to talk too much about that because Larry Solon is an expert on legal interpretation. One of the issues, though, that arises a lot that I personally am interested in is the differences between ambiguity and vagueness. Ambiguity basically is where one word or phrase has more than one possible meaning. Vagueness is where a term can be applied. It's unclear whether a term applies to certain situations. Then the term is vague. So, for example, the word crown is ambiguous because a crown can be something you wear on your head or something you put on your tooth, right? That sort of thing. The word dwelling tends to be somewhat vague because does it apply to a recreational vehicle? Does it apply to a tent? Does it apply to a cave that someone lives in, right? Well, maybe, maybe not, right? That makes the word dwelling somewhat vague. Now, the difference is important because it turns out ambiguity is not that terribly difficult to deal with. You can often anticipate ambiguity, and you can often deal with it by defining a term, for example. Vagueness, on the other hand, is almost impossible. In fact, it's completely impossible to completely get rid of it. And sometimes it's nice to have some vagueness. Now, that doesn't mean people haven't tried to eliminate vagueness. And one of the famous attempts to do this was done by the Emperor Frederick the Great of Prussia, who was an enlightened despot, as they say. He was enlightened because he corresponded with Voltaire, another French, you know, philosophe. I guess that made him enlightened. But anyway, he was very interested in law. So he had his legal experts draw up a code. We're back to codes, right? Codexes, codes. A series of, turned out it had to be published in several volumes. He wanted to have all of the law of Prussia written down in definitive form, in a way that there would be no vagueness, so that the judges would never have to interpret anything. It would all be very clear to them. So in order to do this, the law had to be very long. It ended up being 17,000 provisions. And ultimately, it failed. It simply was impossible to write, even with 17,000 provisions, to anticipate every possible situation and to eliminate all possible vagueness. It's very interesting because, of course, today we still have these sorts of debates, right? Plain meaning, Justice Scalia, and it didn't work with Frederick, you know? It's probably not going to work with Justice Scalia and his textualism either, if it didn't work way back when things were much simpler and there was less need for law than there is today. Now, another monarch actually came up with a more interesting code about 100 years later, and this was the French Civil Code of 1804, I think it is. Is that right, Jeff? Do you remember off the bat? Anyway, whenever it was exactly. Also known as the Code Napoleon. And Napoleon learned from Frederick. What he learned was, don't be too specific. Sometimes vagueness isn't too bad. And so the Code Napoleon was written in a more general sense and had far fewer, about 2,000 to 3,000 articles. And judges were given a certain amount of leeway to interpret it. And as a result, the Code Napoleon is with us today. In fact, not only is it with us in France in modified form, it's spread out throughout much of Southern Europe and Latin America and so forth. So interesting lesson in drafting and interpretation. All right, I need to move on here because we have other speakers. Part three talks about multilingualism, translation, some of the problems that you have. A lot of the chapters in part three discuss the European Union, whereas you may know, European Union law is expressed in 23 different official languages, each one of which is authentic. So a European judge, in determining the meaning of a provision of a directive, has to examine, in theory at least, all 23 different versions. And this is actually rather difficult. How exactly they do that? Well, you'll have to read the book. We have a couple of chapters on that. And I just don't want to give away the ending of the story, you know, and give you some incentive to look at it. But anyway, very interesting issues. Sometimes they're, you know, much handier to have one language, which is authentic. There actually is a group of scholars in Europe that is trying to do this with a model civil code. They're trying to create, legal scholars, trying to create a model civil code for Europe. That would be like a restatement. And they've decided we need one language. And they decided, well, today that language is probably English, and so they're going to use English. I actually was at a conference in Italy where this was discussed. I suggest, why don't you use Latin? You've got this long history of Latin, right? They pretty much booted me out of the room. They didn't like my idea about Esperanto any better. But anyway, they chose English. Now, what was the problem with English? English comes with all kinds of baggage attached to it. It's connected. These legal terms are all connected to the common law system. They want to use English legal terminology without the baggage. Does that work? We're about to find out. But anyway, there's some discussion about that in Chapter 3. Part 4, talks about language rights. I'm not going to talk about that too much, but talks about language rights in Europe and the European system in Africa, for example, Nigeria, with 410 different languages. How do they choose an official language? And the answer is, they can't make an indigenous language official, so they ended up using the former colonial language, English. Much as they hated to do that, English was the obvious choice because that's what the educated group of people knew. So that's a bit about language rights. We then talk about language and criminal law, where we go over issues like Miranda rights, Miranda warnings, the right to remain silent, interrogation. That's the topic of Richard Leo, so I'm not going to steal his thunder. On that particular one, part six, we talk about courtroom discourse. We have chapters on courtroom discourse in the United States, then a chapter on the Netherlands, which is a fairly typical civil law system, and then also a chapter on China and a chapter on Japan. Japan is interesting because they have started to adopt lay judges, something like lay jurors. And so that raises some very interesting issues. Japan, Korea, and several other countries, in fact, have started to do that. It's interesting. They are expanding lay judges at the same time that the common law system is restricting the use of juries. So in England, they no longer use juries in civil, except for very rare cases, in civil cases. No juries anymore. And that's where the jury was born. But then now they're restricted pretty much to criminal law. And in the United States, statistics show that juries are being used in fewer. There's a dramatic decline in the number of jury trials over the last 20 years or so. So we're sort of getting away from juries. And then in Japan and Korea, Russia, they're experimenting with something like juries, although they technically are lay judges. Sort of an interesting issue. Then finally, last couple of chapters, or the last parts. Part seven is on intellectual property, where we talk about linguistic issues in copyright law, trademark law, and so forth. And then we have a couple of chapters on linguistic expertise in areas like, can you identify a writer by the way that a person writes? And the answer is, well, somewhat. It's difficult, because the pieces of text, for example, in a suicide note or a threat are often too short to really do good analysis. But you can, the linguist can give you at least some information on these sorts of issues. But we've got an entire part on that, and then we've got a part on speaker identification. How well can ordinary people identify voices? And the answer is, well, if it's a familiar voice, fairly well. But if it's not a familiar voice, if they haven't heard it too terribly often, it turns out they're not nearly as good. That's sort of what you'd expect. But the legal system tends to have a lot more confidence in ear witness identification than they ought to, it seems to me. And then finally, there's a question of, can you identify a person's place of origin by how they speak? And it turns out that this is a huge deal in Europe, where the immigration services of many European countries, in deciding whether someone qualifies for asylum, are starting to have linguists or native speakers of a particular language determine whether the applicant is, in fact, a native speaker of some language in Uganda or whatever country you have to be from in order to get asylum. And this has turned into a very controversial topic. Now, it turns out, and here we're sort of segueing back, and I'm getting to the end here, to the codex. It turns out that people have been using language to determine place of origin for thousands of years. Because the most famous codex of all, as I mentioned, is the Bible, right? Now, if we look at the book of Judges in the Bible, it turns out that way back when, the Gileadites were fighting with the Ephraimites. I have to check my notes because these are not, I'm not sure exactly who these people were. But anyway, one of them, I believe, was one of the tribes of Israel. And the other may have been one of the lost tribes of Israel. I'm not entirely sure about this, but they were fighting. And the Gileadites defeated the Ephraimites. And so, Book of Judges, I think it's chapter 12. So now the Ephraimites wanted to cross back over the River Jordan and go back to their home country. And now it says in the Book of Judges, Gilead then cut Ephraim off from the fords of the Jordan. And whenever Ephraimite refugees said, let me cross, the men of Gilead would ask, are you an Ephraimite? And if he said no, well, if they said yes, they killed him. This is Hobson's choice. If they said no, right, then, now I'm quoting once again,